I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. You know the saying, someone's got to do it? You have to wonder if that's what went through John Gibson's mind when he said yes to being chair of the Democratic Party in Kansas. Today we'll ask him why he took the job, how the party will build on the 13 seats they picked up in the state house, and what are his long-range plans for Democrats in Kansas. First, though, a little March Madness. Warning, if you've already filled out your brackets, you might want to rethink them. We'll learn about the model developed by a KU professor to help predict the Final Four in the NCAA tournament. Then Bill Brownlee brings us this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's that time of year when you start seeing a lot of clothing emblazoned with college names being worn around town. I think I even saw a Northwestern sweatshirt on the way to work this morning. That can only mean one thing. The NCAA basketball tournament, March Madness, is once again taking over otherwise sane people. If you haven't worn out your erasers filling in your bracket predictions, or if you're bold enough to do it in ink, you may want to think about printing out another one. That's because the University of Kansas professor has developed a statistical model to predict the winners at each stage of the NCAA tournament. It's a model that uses data from all 351 Division I teams. Joining me now is that professor. That's Jonathan Templin. He's an associate professor of educational psychology at KU. Jonathan, good to have you. Good morning.
Thank you, Steve. Nice to be here.
And for our listeners, what team is your pick to win it all? Or do you think any of the Kansas teams have what it takes? Let us know what you think. 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Or tweet us at KCUR up to date. So tell me, Jonathan, are you afraid this information will fall into the wrong hands here? I mean, this is powerful stuff you've got going here.
Well, about the wrong hands, I think you probably mean the competitors that are entered in the same competitions I have, perhaps.
Yes.
but no, I don't think the use of this is bad in any way. I think it's just it's for fun. It's for trying to see what's going to happen, particularly with the NCAA tournament with 68 teams, now 66.
Yeah.
A lot of them, I don't know a lot about what that team does. So it's kind of helpful as a kind of a roadmap of what to expect a little bit.
Well, have you had any inquiries from odds makers, bookmakers out in Vegas who are saying, hey, I could use what you got cooking here?
Thankfully, no. I think the best way to go about gambling is to find stock in the casino that you might put a place of bet on and put on there, because the casino seems to win regardless.
Well, the first round of the men's Division I games are coming up tomorrow. Any spoilers you want to let us in on here?
Oh, that's a good one. I think when it comes to what happens tomorrow, I think there's a little bit less. There are a few chances for upsets here or there. I think Wichita State, although it's a 10 seed, it looks like it's got a fairly good shot at moving on. Another one to look at, K-State won last night, and I think when they go up against Cincinnati, I think they also have a fairly decent shot. They're not favored to go against to win against Cincinnati, but I think they'll have a good shot. It'll be a close game.
As you enter in all this information, do the upsets sort of pop out, or is it always just by a slim margin kind of thing?
It can be a little bit of both. It depends. I think sometimes in modeling, you get some clear, interesting results that go against what a seeding or something along those lines. But a lot of times, it's sort of a slim margin. So a lot of the times that we want to make sure when we predict a game, we're not just predicting kind of what the score will be, but also how uncertain we are with that. So you look at for instance, the K-State versus Cincinnati game. I think it's Kansas State has like a 46.3% chance of winning. Well, that's basically saying a toss-up. That's not a great prediction from a model standpoint. But at the same point, if that's accurate, that helps us to say, well, yeah. You know, if you're going to put money on that game, or if you're going to really pick K-State to move on, it's going to be a harder pick, because if the model is accurate, 46% of the time, they'll win. But at the same time, that's a lot of variability.
Do you have a track record here during the course of the regular season? Have you been able to predict at an amazingly accurate level here?
I have not done that with this yet. This is sort of kind of the test tube version of it. I thought it was timely for this part of the year. With other models, a lot of times I've seen about 78-79% accuracy for predicting games, which is not great, but I'm hoping this gets a a little bit better.
So what you have here is fairly new in the makings here, then.
That's exactly right. It's brand new.
And you're going to find out here in the weeks to come just how accurate you are. Do you have a goal in mind? I mean, do you want to hit 65%, 70%? Because if you do, that would be something.
I would like for it to outperform what was done before with simpler models. So I'd like to think that there's some type of evidence to suggest that the more accurate you are scientifically or statistically, the better we get with prediction. But after that, I don't know. I think having accuracy in the high 70s is sort of what I expect. Who knows what's going to happen, though? That's part of the plan for this. It's kind of the beginning. It's kind of a kicking off of it. But there'll be more research being done. I'll hopefully this time next year have a much better chance to tell you what's to be expected.
You know, when you think about it, just from a 10,000-foot view, just the notion that you're trying to predict the actions of 10, 20-year-old boys on a court on any given night is a fairly strange idea.
Yeah, that is a fairly strange idea, and it's fraught with a lot of difficulty. You get a lot of I think that's the part of
you
it.
Think?
It quantify this model helps quantify how off we are, and on average, pick the team. It's somewhere along the lines of 7 or 8 points a game, which a big difference. That's the difference between winning and losing those times.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a really difficult task ahead.
Well, give us a sense, give our listeners mm-hmm. a sense, Jonathan, of exactly what you've come up with here. What kind of information do you enter into the computer? How do you evaluate it? How do you weight it? I mean, give us just a rough sense.
Absolutely. So we take results from each game that's been played this year amongst the 351 Division I teams, as you mentioned. So for each game, there are two scores. There's kind of a Team A versus Team B. What we try to do is predict both of those scores. And what we're basically doing is for each score, there's a team that scored it and a team that it was scored against, kind of a scoring mm-hmm. and a defending, if you will. So we quantify kind of each team's scoring effect and each team's defending effect. So if Kansas is playing, let's say, Oklahoma State, their last regular season game, KU would have sort of a kind of an effect of how well they score, and they would be going up against how well Oklahoma State scores. Now, that's for one of the scores of the game. The other score of the game would be the opposite. Oklahoma mm-hmm. State's scoring would go against Kansas's defense. And so with the quantification of that, we're sort of taking into consideration the strength of each team on their offense and defense. Also considered with that is also where the game was played, whether it was played in Oklahoma State, Allen Fieldhouse, where have you. And then along with that, we put a couple other variables in, such as whether the game was a conference game or not, and neutral site related mm-hmm. as well. And the interesting thing with that, so that gives us sort of a prediction for the scores.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that the model tries to do is figure out if there's some tendency for the predictions to be off based on the teams that are playing. So sort of a team consistency effect.
So every time KU plays Baylor, for instance, maybe Baylor does better than other teams tend to do for some idiosyncratic reason.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Right. So we want to come up with so we try to do the same process, but also how much variability each team has in their scores.
Mm-hmm.
So if Kansas actually is one of the more consistent teams this year, and so the model is basically saying, well, it scores a lot, or it defends. The difference between it playing an average team is pretty high, but it's also really consistent. And so when you factor both of those in together, the rating sort of represents a standardized metric of how far Kansas would score above some other team itself.
You know, I imagine when you go into something like this, and people have tried before, there are so many decisions you've got to make as to what you're going to evaluate, how much weight you're going to put on those different metrics. I mean, you could think about this forever, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. A lot of variables. You think about it, the data that we have, it's a lot of data, but at the same time, it's very high, like you said, 10,000-foot level, just two scores from each game. Mm-hmm. We didn't have who played in the game. We're not using that sort of the aggregated into the team effect. There are so many things that we could put in that we're not doing. We could add more, and I think this is just kind of the beginning point for it. I think when you look at where this might go or what other systems that are out there, they have more things that get involved, and I think the more involved we have a better chance of doing better at the prediction.
You know, each team plays roughly 30 times a year, give or take a few games, and I'm wondering, is that enough examples of an activity that will lend itself to predictive models here?
That's a great question. I think if you think about the way that sports analytics work, baseball seems to be the gold standard. You have so many 162 games per season for the major league teams. That seems to be. The more data that we have, the better we tend to get with predicting things. 30 games, I think, is a fair amount of games. I think we probably would have a better chance at 30 than we would predicting, for instance, the college football season or the NFL season.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that's a question that research is we're trying to decide. Is, you know, are we just hamstrung by the number of games? I mean, modeling wise, hamstrung by the number of games we've played. And I think ultimately. That's a good question. I don't know. I don't have an answer for that.
So at this point, to sort of hypothesize that the NBA is, you can predict those games better because they play more often, or Major League Baseball, that wouldn't be a bad hypothesis to work off.
That is spot on, actually.
So. Yeah. Okay. Jonathan Templin's my guest. He's an associate professor of educational psychology over at KU. He's developed a new model for predicting the outcomes of NCAA basketball games. March Madness coming up here. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is the number. Do you have predictions of all the games right there?
I have some.
People want to call in?
Yeah, they're welcome to call in. I do have sort of the probability a team makes a given round, and we should sort of backward track what that means about the next games that are playing. Moreover than that, on my website, there are this model essentially to come up with these probabilities, create a 10,000 simulated brackets. I mean, and so you can actually download the brackets that it created and, you know, fill one out, use it in your bracket pool, although with caution.
Where can people go to see these things?
My website, jonathantemplin.com.
Okay. And you can look at all 10,000.
All 10,000 if you want.
Really?
Be a while. But yeah, more specifically, each one of those is sort of a simulated tournament it thought it could happen.
Yeah.
And you'll see a lot of variability in it. You'll see crazy upsets. You'll see, you know, things that, you know, could happen but likely won't.
And on your site, then, do you have one bracket that seems to be the most probable set of outcomes here?
I don't have that. What I have is sort of an aggregate of those 10,000, what percentage of the time or what proportion of the time did the team advance to a given round. And so, mm-hmm. for instance, Kansas looks like it has a 97.
Don't give the final four result. We're going to keep our listeners. But as you have them moving on, though, after the
Absolutely,
first round?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, a 97% chance of them moving on.
97 to get out of the first round.
That's right. That's right.
To get to the Sweet 16, then.
That's right. But that also means that
that's, you know, pretty strong.
2.6% of those brackets have them being the first number one seed to be upset by 16. So, and you know, in looking at this and putting it online, of course, that happened to be two or the three of the brackets that I just eyeballed myself. Oh, look at that. KU lost in the first round. Huh?
So again, if you go to jonathantemplin.com, your website, mm-hmm. do you have the most likely bracket sort of highlighted there that people can look at?
Yeah, the tournament predictions do give kind of the chances of each team moving on. And I think that's close enough to the most likely. You can kind of take the top and go down and kind of think about how to build a bracket off of that.
Are you going to recalibrate after each round?
Yeah, that's the plan. Trying to come up with another guess as to what would happen next. And the other fun thing for me is, you know, we have 10,000 simulations of these brackets. That's a lot, it sounds like, but the odds of actually having any of them survive past round one or two are very slim. So the question is, if this was a survivor pool, how long can those 10,000 brackets last? That's the fun thing for me to find out.
So there's a chance, obviously, here that we could go through all 10,000 simulations and none of them have the results of how this tournament actually plays out, given the fact there are, 68 teams that start off with.
Exactly. 67 games overall. And even with knowing a thing or two about the teams, we're the chances of having any of those 10,000 make it all the way through, or even make it through the Elite Eight, are slim, very slim.
That's amazing. That's when people hand me a bracket every year. I always think, why should I bother? Because it's like picking lottery numbers to me.
Exactly. It sort of is. It's sort of also the competition. Now, if it's relative to perfection, yeah, why do you bother? But if it's relative to the guy down the hall who, you know, roots for the team that you shouldn't be rooting for, I think it's maybe.
Yeah.
It's where the fun happens, I think.
Well, how do you think Las Vegas odds makers and bookmakers feel about what you're doing? Because are you going to improve the prospects of people winning more often than they don't? And does that change their business model out there?
I don't think so. I think at least my impression of what happens is, you know, they set a sort of a line for a game, kind of how many points a team will be different. And then based on betting trends, they move that line. So that line effectively is not quite a commodity, kind of like a commodities market, but it sort of is. It functions that way.
It's set so they can't lose.
That's right. And so based on that, no, I don't think that's going to happen. What, you know, if you wanted to use this for a gambling sense, there are ways that you could do so. You could basically take a look at the line, and for any, you know, any given game, you could come up with what this model says the point differential should be. And there's sort of a distribution around that, and you can calculate the probability you'd win the bet with any given point spread. I don't have that up on the website. I think that's kind of getting into a place where I probably, you know, ethically it may not be good. But at the same time, I think you could do that. You could be better informed. I think if you are inclined to gamble, it's not always placing a bet. It's placing the right bets if you're trying to win money.
Mm-hmm. Are there some variables out there, Jonathan, that are just hard to account for that you can't get into your model that somehow you wish you could?
There are a few. Looking at right now, I mean, we just have a team A playing team B. And if you look at, for instance, the Big 12 tournament with Kansas, Josh Jackson didn't play the first game. The model doesn't account for that. The only way it accounts for that is looking at the consistency of Kansas's score, but it doesn't directly account for the impact that.
So an injury during the course of the tournaments could throw things off.
Absolutely. Injury, some other, the University of Michigan's basketball team had a plane accident, right before they flew to the Big Ten tournament.
They went off the runway or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Things that just show up, there's so much that could happen. Even, down to the level of how the officials like the coach or, just whatever bias might actually show up from officiating. There's so many things that could go in that we don't have. And that's why you see the model is not great at, narrowing in on exactly where the point spread should or what the point should be itself.
I mean, you could begin to think about ideas like how much of a deduction would you take off a team's performance if this player was injured, that player was injured. I mean, you could just go on forever with this.
Absolutely.
Stuff.
And I think that ultimately gets to the bigger picture. The more stuff we can put in, if we could come up with a better sense of how a team's score reflects each of the players that contribute it, then we start getting into it. Now you start getting into the models that are so nuanced, you're down to the level of the possession, it gets a lot harder. And I think you start to see things like you'd see in weather forecasting where, you have these global forecast models and the saying of, a butterfly flaps its wings in India and there's a monsoon or, there's a hurricane over in the East Pacific or something like that. So,
well, before we get to your final four prediction, your background's in psychology, Jonathan. So what led you to this project? I mean, how did you get involved here?
Well, I love sports and I love statistics. And so it's sort of a nice kind of combination of what I do for what I do. My background in psychology is more on what's called quantitative psychology, which is sort of the statistics that go under the research that we do in psychology, and also a big component of what we do with psychological testing, educational testing, and so forth. And the models really aren't that much different. There's some generalities between the two, but generally speaking, you're up against the same math behind each type of model in each field. And so one of the fun things about that is, you take a model from one field and you try to put it to use in another, and not only do you learn about the model, you also learn about other ways of modeling data so you can get better at it as you go forward.
So where did you go to get all the stats that you entered into this system?
There are a couple websites out there. SportsReference.com has all the data from the regular season, and then to actually put this together, I wrote a program that tries to estimate the model parameters and do the simulation.
Man, okay. That sounds like a whole lot of stuff. What's your plan for the model going forward?
I'd like to see if it works, and see how to improve it. What's the best we could do with this type of information before we have to get a little more involved with, like you said, player ratings or other types of data that we could put into it?
Okay, well, the big moment has come here. Let's talk about the bracket that you have as the most likely set of outcomes for this tournament. Who are your final four picks?
Well, if you're going off of numbers, Gonzaga would be one, Villanova would be another, KU would be another. Mm-hmm. So three number one seeds. And then the question comes from the bracket that includes North Carolina, because that one you may have, I think that's with Kentucky. Mm-hmm. You might see, it looks like Kentucky would be favored over North Carolina, but slightly. So,
yeah. So you're basically picking number one picks, which would make sense because you're basing this off of performance during the course of the season.
That's it. And the way I pick my bracket that I entered into a couple different pools I'm in, I looked at the most likely final four teams that came out of these 10,000 simulations, and I took one of those. Took the group of brackets that look like that and grab one at random and just plug that in to see kind of one of the anchor the choices for the final four with the highest certainty, but then allow the flexibility, the chance of upsets to filter through.
Do you have an overall winner for the whole tournament?
The most likely winner is Gonzaga right now
really?
For this model, which is interesting to me.
Are they number one seed?
They are number one seed. Yeah, okay. They had a great season this year. But interestingly enough, one of their conference has another team that's doing well, which is St. Mary's. The Model likes St. Mary's as well, for whatever reason. So the open question is that an issue with the Model, or is that an issue with, is that accurate? So I guess we will find out.
A lot of people around here are going to be disappointed if Gonzaga wins this thing and not KU.
Myself included.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Jonathan Templin, again, Associate Professor of Educational Psychology over at KU, thanks for the good insights, and let's see how you do, and if you knock them out, come on back, we'll talk about it
again. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Time for a break here. When we come back, we'll talk with the man who's signed up to be the head of the Kansas Democratic Party in a bright red state. Why would he do it? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Well, Kansas Democrats have a new leader as they struggle to emerge from a long stay in what's called the political wilderness. Their new chairman is John Gibson, who's a lawyer. He went to MIT, and he lives in the country near Topeka. One has to wonder why anyone would want this job, and we're about to find out the answer to that question. And, John, welcome to Up to Date. So good to have you back.
Thanks, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you have the floor here, John. Why would anybody in their right minds want the job of leading a flock of Democrats in one of the most solidly red states in the entire country?
Well, I'm very optimistic about the future of Kansas and America and the Democratic Party, particularly in Kansas. There's not a place I'd rather be as a Democrat right now.
Why do you say that?
There's a lot of reasons. Let me focus on one, at least first. Everywhere I've gone since being elected state chair of the party, we have had more enthusiasm, more Democrats in attendance than we ever expected or plan for, even. We've been bringing chairs into meeting after meeting around the state.
Why do you think that is?
Certainly some of it is for bad reasons, because of the unfortunate damage that's been done to Kansas by our political opponents and to the country as well, increasingly. But there's also, especially in younger people who are becoming involved in the process for the first time, I think a realization as to how important this is, how important civic engagement is, and an enthusiasm for stepping up and participating that maybe even, you know, my generation as a Gen Xer, maybe we did not have.
Well, that's kind of a refreshing turn of circumstances there.
I'm very encouraged, and it's exciting. And I see a lot of potential there. There's a lot of people ready to do the work. Now it's up to the state party and our candidates to be in the game and give people an opportunity to help us out and oftentimes lead us as well.
Ultimately, tell me if I'm wrong, it is a lot of work. You just use that word. I mean, this is just some things don't change despite the internet and everything else. Going out, knocking on doors, pamphlets, flyers, phone calls, all that stuff is what we're talking about here.
That's absolutely right. And I think one of the most important things for us to realize is that perhaps because of the internet, because of so many channels on cable television now, the person-to-person direct connection is more valuable than ever before. Mm-hmm. And organizing at a county party level, at a precinct level, at a state house or state senate district level, or a city council district level is more valuable than ever and connects with people in a way that somehow in the current internet age is more authentic and meaningful, it seems, than, you know, just another Facebook post.
So how is the Kansas Democratic Party then providing the tools to these people that they need to go out and do the things you're talking about here, John, like organizing cities and counties and maybe even in places where it hasn't been done in a long time?
Well, we're working on it, certainly. It's a work in progress. Some of what we're doing is that I, as the chair, am traveling around the state and trying to engage with as many Democrats or perhaps future Democrats as possible. We also have an excellent staff. Just in the past few weeks, we've been organizing county after county. Kiowa County recently got organized.
Where is Kiowa County?
It's south, mm-hmm. southwest of okay. here, not truly southwest Kansas.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is exciting to have our staff, our volunteers who are actually going from county to county, from meeting to meeting to engage with people. And sometimes you need to lead by example to show that it's important to get out and engage. Sometimes it's specific training that is needed to help put together, say, a stump speech for the Water Commission race or that sort of support we can provide. We're working to be a hub of ideas and communications to help our county parties and our local organizers interact with one another and learn from one another.
John Gibson, the new chairman of the Kansas Democratic Party, is my guest here. You know, as you move into some of these counties, what do you find is the first order of business? What do you have to do to begin the process of getting a county organized on behalf of Kansas Democrats?
So the organization process is actually something that's in Kansas statute in terms of a political party organization. So to begin with, you really need to identify who your elected precinct people are, who are elected in a primary process, and call a meeting of those individuals to hold an election of a chair and the other officers and to officially form a county party.
And a lot of places that hasn't happened yet?
We are doing well. We are making great gains. And that is an important part of what the party does, but that's certainly not the only part that the party does. There's even in counties without an officer corps, you know, we want to be working to identify activists. One of our missions is to show up in every corner of the state as a party.
There's 105 counties.
Yes.
Of those, how many are organized?
We are right at about 70.
Okay, so you're 70, mm-hmm. Yeah. 68%,
yeah.
Something
yeah.
like that. That's
yeah.
not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. And can you see yourself getting to 90, 95% at some point?
We are sure making a great strides there and great efforts there. But at the same time, we're also wanting to focus on things like recruiting candidates in every county. You know, one of the best ways we found in organizing counties is that if you can have candidates who have been successful or who have put in a race, you have volunteers then who mm-hmm. are, you know, who have been engaged with those campaigns. And it's not a while I put a lot of emphasis on county parties because I was a former county party chair, perhaps, that's not the end-all and be-all of the party either. It's also important for us to have candidates. That's ultimately the name of the game. We're a political party. We are here to elect candidates. And it's about organizing at the grassroots level and engaging people in as many ways as we can.
Just hearing you talk about this, you know, you can readily begin to imagine that this is a huge undertaking you've just signed up to do here.
Yeah. There is a lot involved, and fortunately, we have an excellent staff at the state party office, and I'm not the only officer that was elected. I'm not the only person embarking on this adventure. We have a team that is ready and invigorated to meet this challenge. And we have, in a less official capacity, an enormous amount of activists who are excited at the prospects of Democrats in Kansas and the good work we can do. And they're engaged as well. And that extends our reach immensely. It's not all me. It's only a tiny fraction me.
John Gibson is my guest. He's the new chairman of the Kansas Democratic Party. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is the number here. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Well, you have a law practice. I'm wondering, how do you manage to devote the time you need to devote to a job that doesn't pay a whole lot because you're a young guy?
And I have children who are in college.
Say, you get in college, okay.
Yes.
You're not so young then. I take that back.
Well, you know, we had children very young in life. I'm quite young still.
Yeah, yeah.
Now,
okay.
You know, it's a challenge. I was focusing on my patent law practice this morning, commencing about 7:30, got a couple hours of work in on that, drove into the studio here from the country north of Topeka. And after we're done off the air here, I've got some meetings in the area. But first, I'll spend an hour or two in a coffee shop or the library working on some patent stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll have my meetings. Then I'll work on my law practice some more in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the deal that I've signed up for.
You've got to begin to think that if a time like this isn't conducive to what Democrats want to do, you wonder when that time will ever come. I mean, the table is set, in a sense. The frustration with President Trump in some quarters, not all, and then obviously frustration with Governor Brownback, who continues to poll as the least popular governor in the entire country. I mean, that's not a bad situation to walk into from a purely political standpoint here.
We certainly have an opportunity to make gains and to make our case to the voters in a way that perhaps hadn't been the case before, simply because of the problems that have been created by our opponents. More than having an opportunity, though, I want to emphasize that we have an obligation to try to step up and fix these problems. We have an obligation to engage in the political and electoral process to offer solutions that are desperately needed right now.
Mm-hmm. Solutions like what? Give me a sense of what you might be talking about.
In Kansas, just very specifically, you know, we look at the taxation problems that have wrecked our state budget. We look at the school funding situation and restoring an adequate funding formula. Those are issues where, you know, those details have to be worked out by legislators, but it's important that we have Democratic legislators and Democratic candidates for the legislature stepping up to offer those solutions and be involved in that discussion. And we get involved by having votes in the legislature.
Well, it's tricky, though, for guys like you, because one obvious solution might be raising taxes. Mm-hmm. I mean, the taxes were cut a lot. There's been big budget deficits. Mm-hmm. And now politicians in the state who want to assume mm-hmm. command have to run on this notion that, hey, we've got to raise taxes mm-hmm. to get the state back to where it was. And that's no fun.
It absolutely isn't fun. And there's an importance to being authentic about the solutions. And I do try to be mindful of the roles in politics. My job as the chairman of the Kansas Democratic Party is to organize the Kansas Democrats so that we can win elections, so that we can participate in solving these problems. And certainly we need to restore some balance to the taxation system in the state of Kansas. It's gotten out of whack. But the best way I can help fix that is to focus on recruiting and supporting candidates for the state legislature who will be empowered then to be part of the solution.
Mm. And how hard is it to find those people who want to run for office these days as a Democrat in Kansas?
Well, historically, and as someone who was a county chair back in the early 2000s.
Here in Johnson County, by the way.
In Johnson County before I moved out to the country, yes. Historically, it's been very hard to recruit candidates. And I expect that will continue in at least some instances. However, we have had an incredible amount of enthusiasm for people who feel called to run for office, who feel it is important for them and what they believe in to engage in the system, whether that is as a candidate for the state house, whether that is a candidate for the county commission, or whether that is as a precinct person. We have had people coming forward already eager to learn what is involved in a state house run so that they can evaluate with their families whether that is something they should take on. And that's been gratifying. We have some wonderful individuals who have expressed an interest in that way already.
Do you feel like sometimes, John, there's this sort of mystery that surrounds the whole notion of running for office and that, hey, you know, it's real people, regular people who just go off to Topeka mm-hmm. who have concerns about one issue or another, who tend to be people who step forward, and mm-hmm. maybe there isn't so much mystery to it after all.
You know, you're right. There's sometimes this notion from those who have not been as engaged in the system that it takes some special, extraordinary skill or perhaps some unusual character trait to get involved
or
in the political process.
Or whatever, and just from years spent covering over there, rest assured that super high IQs are not a requirement. I've seen a lot of people who don't qualify.
These are ordinary folks who have stepped up.
And it should be.
Exactly. That's mm-hmm. the way our system is structured and built and depends upon. And even people who I disagree with politically, I greatly respect their willingness to serve and to step up. Mm-hmm. And I am encouraging Democrats to do the same now and have been gratified by that. Ordinary people can do great things working together.
You know, if there are 125 members of a Kansas House, what's your goal going forward, John? Do you want to have candidates in all 125
absolutely.
Slots there, or how do you see it?
We absolutely need candidates in all 125 slots. And obviously, I'm not naive. Some of those districts are harder to recruit in than others. But the election calendar and the election map dictates which battles we have, and we need to be engaged in those. And that means fielding candidates, fielding quality candidates, and then supporting those candidates in all 125 state house districts.
You know, you've got to beat somebody with somebody. That's the old saying. And to that end, There's some question whether your 2014 candidate for governor, obviously a key person on the ballot, you know, coming up here next year, that's Paul Davis. Mm-hmm. He's a former House Minority Leader and a lawyer from Lawrence. There's some question whether he's going to run again for governor or whether he'll run for Congress over in the Topeka area in the second district. What's your best sense of what he plans to do?
My best sense is that Paul, who's I think would have made an excellent governor, will be making a decision in the next little bit of time. I mean, he certainly has plenty of time to consider and contemplate, and he'll be making an announcement in due course, I'm sure.
Yeah. I imagine you'd like to see him run again.
I think Paul Davis is a very talented individual, and full disclosure, he's a friend of mine. He's someone I've known over the years. The party and the state chair obviously has to be neutral should there be a primary in any sort of election, and I'm mindful of that.
There's a former mayor of Wichita who's already running, Carl Brewer, right?
Yes, yeah. Who's also a great guy. I have not known Carl Brewer as long as I've known Paul Davis, but I've had a chance to get to know him a little bit over the past few weeks, and frankly, I think he's also a great guy, and I'm supportive of all of our Democratic candidates if we have primaries, without favoring one or the other, but certainly back to Paul Davis, he's a talented public servant, and I look forward to him being back in the arena soon.
You know, if he were not to step forward, if he were to go to Congress, you've got a blank spot at the top of your ballot next year, and at a time when Democrats have a terrific opportunity, perhaps, to pull off a win like that, that would be a problem.
And as you just noted, though, Carl Brewer, the former mayor of Wichita, has already declared that he's running for governor. And I suspect, but certainly do not know and can't confirm yet, that there are other Democrats interested in running for that position.
Yeah.
I think that we will know more about that in the next few weeks and months as they're considering their options. And I look forward to that. If we have a primary process, that's great. It can be a spirited primary process. If we coalesce behind someone, that's great too. That's not really my job as the chair of the party to manage. I want to make sure everyone has a chance to get out there and compete and then unify behind whoever the voters select in the Democratic primary.
And again, just so our listeners sort of get this, traditionally at least, the best path for a statewide office in Kansas or anywhere has been to hold a down-ballot statewide office. Yep. Kathleen Sebelius, for instance, was insurance commissioner and rose from that position to become governor.
Yes.
And right now, Democrats don't hold any of those other statewide seats.
That's correct.
And again,
that's an issue we're looking at as well.
For a guy like John Gibson, yeah.
Exactly. And one, you asked about the state house races, and it's important to have 125 candidates for 125 state house districts. It's also important for us to have candidates in all of the statewide offices. We're actively recruiting candidates for those positions right now, and rather like the state house recruitment, we have talented individuals expressing interest already, and I'm optimistic that we'll have good news on those fronts in the next few months.
So again, as a chairman, you've got to make these decisions, John. Do you focus on a race for governor? That might be tough. Do you focus on filling state house races? Do you focus on the state senate, down ballot statewide offices? I mean, you only have so many resources. You only have so much time. And again, those decisions become critical.
They do. At the same time, though, there's a couple of different things I've been telling people. First of all, we as a party have to be able to do more than one thing at a time. We have to be able to support a gubernatorial candidate and our state house races.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, though, by doing the work of the party, by registering voters, by organizing Democrats, by helping precinct people walk their precincts and getting the vote out, we help all of our candidates. Mm-hmm. And so we need to focus on what the party does, and things will go okay for us if we make our case and have good candidates.
I should point out that before 2018, you've got an interesting congressional race coming up next month, actually, in the Wichita area. This is the special election for the seat that Mike Pompeo once held until President Trump named him his CIA director. The Republicans have nominated a state treasurer, Ron Estes. You guys are going with civil rights attorney James Thompson. There's some thought that you Democrats have a shot here, that the Democrats in Washington see this race as one that could potentially flip and embarrass President Trump in a state that he carried easily last November. How do you see this thing?
Well, I was just down in Wichita yesterday, actually, spent some time down there and met with the Thompson campaign and other good Democrats down in the area in the 4th Congressional District. And special elections are tricky things. Enthusiasm turns into votes, and votes turn into wins in what are traditionally low turnout elections.
Right.
There's been a lot of work put in by the Thompson campaign and by the Kansas Democratic Party in that special election. And there's not a model for this. This isn't something that happens frequently in Kansas or in the 4th District particularly. So we're in uncharted territory. What we know is we're digging in, we're fighting for that spot, and that's what we're here to do. That's how the system works, and we have a great candidate, and we're excited to have a chance to compete.
And just a final point here. There's another question about how you want to position this party going forward, John. One of your predecessors practically got run out of the state for suggesting that the party try to appeal more to moderate Republicans as the only practical way to grow the Democratic Party. So I wanted to ask you, does your party need to appeal more to moderate Republicans as a way to grow?
The Democratic Party in Kansas needs to appeal to a wide range of people. Certainly, certain current circumstances have, I think, opened the door to appealing to those who would consider themselves more moderate or perhaps not traditionally Democrats to look at what our opponents have done and consider what Democrats have to say.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, though, I'm not interested in the Democratic Party not being the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
We're Democrats. We have certain core values.
So
around.
You want it both ways, in a sense.
I think we have to make our case to people all over the political spectrum. And we know, because we've seen the surveys, you've seen the surveys, that people vote for candidates, as they just did for president, who perhaps they disagree with on a number of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the important things we can do as a party is to recruit candidates who will make an authentic pitch to voters for what they want to do and what they believe in. And I think the good people of Kansas value that and will appreciate that and not necessarily be going down a checklist of, well, are they sufficiently this or that? We need to be authentic, real people offering real, genuine solutions that we believe in, and we'll do okay.
That's John Gibson. He's the new chairman of the Kansas Democratic Party. John, thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome.
Come back and see us, okay?
Sure will. Thank you, Steve.
KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is back with this week's Local Listen. And Bill, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Quick switcheroo there. Yeah. This week you've got a band that's more to my taste. Let's snap to some jazz here with Everett Devan, who's a longtime mainstay in the Kansas City jazz scene. In fact, I believe he's the dean of the scene. And yes, that rhymes there, dean of the scene. Tell us about him.
Well, I'd say if he belonged to a was affiliated with anything politically, it would be the party.
Mm-hmm.
Everett Devan is a good time jazz organist in the old school tradition of the late 50s and early 1960s. Yet here he is in 2017, still bringing that sound.
Let's listen to Everett Devan. This is Blue Greens and Beans from the album For the Love of You. Bill, he plays the organ, and you don't hear that often in the jazz world or any world that often these days. What do you make of it?
Well, when I hear that organ,
it's pretty good.
You know, it just makes me want to smoke cigarettes and drink whiskey. You know, that's what's the default barroom sound of much of America, you know, 50 years ago. And it still has that, you know, smoky, dirty,
yes,
you know, make you want to sin sound.
Mm-hmm. You know, he's a mentor for a lot of younger players in town. Do I have that right because of his experience on the scene?
That's right. He's been around so long that a lot of younger musicians have learned pretty much everything they know from him. Chris Hazleton, the young B3 organist, among them. There are guys like the guitarist we're hearing right now, Matt Hopper, is a young musician who was mentored by Everett.
Yeah. Everett's had his health challenges of late, too.
Yeah, you know, it could have something to do with playing all those years in those smoky dives before the laws were changed.
Yeah. You can see and hear Everett Van Ware coming up here.
He plays all over town, but his next gig is Monday at the Blue Room.
And that's a jam session, so you can hang out and listen for a while, and other stuff's going to go on.
Yeah, typically the way it works is the leader of the jam session, this guy's Everett, will play a set, and then the second set, anyone brave enough can sign up, and he may call your name, and you can join him on stage.
Well, that sounds good. That's Bill Brownlee with this week's Local Listen, who featured Everett Devan, the track again, Blue Greens and Beans, from the album For the Love of You. Bill, thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, how forensic science is returning undocumented migrants, the remains of those migrants, back to their families. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.